You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, technology moves fast. It's hard to know if things like Spotify, Instagram, or Google Docs, for example, will be there in the future. We'll talk to two archivists about what it takes to save and preserve things on the internet. Now, most school districts in Wisconsin do not require masks. Just a few weeks into the new school year, at least one school district in Mondovi has had a COVID-related closure. And over 1,000 students and staff in districts around the state have had to quarantine after being exposed to the virus. Around the country, places with lower vaccination rates have had school outbreaks in the first few weeks of the new school year. We're talking now about the start of school as the Delta variant continues to spread. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's going on in your school district? Have there been COVID cases? Do you think masks should be required in schools? How about vaccines for those students and employees who are eligible? Are you the parent of a child who has a disability or an underlying health condition? What are your thoughts on masks? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Erin Richards is a news reporter who covers K-12 education for USA Today. She's based in Milwaukee. Erin, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, good to be here.
We've heard from President Biden recommending that schools require vaccinations for staff, have universal masking, regular testing for people who are unvaccinated. As you look around in districts around the country, how common is that?
Well, what we know is that the likelihood of districts taking up mask mandates is really highly dependent on the politics of the region. So there's a number of different ways that folks have been tracking this around the country, but we don't have a set tracker just for mask mandates. Vaccine mandates are certainly becoming kind of inching down the road for staff. Really only one big district, Los Angeles, has required vaccines or is going to require vaccines for eligible students. And the rest of the protocols and mitigation strategies are really kind of all over the place. We're seeing in larger urban districts, it's more likely that kids are required to wear masks as well as staff. That's certainly the recommendation from the federal government and the CDC. But schools don't necessarily have to follow those recommendations, right? Schools are locally run by local school boards, long history of local control in our country. And so districts can make up their own rules. However, we have seen more of these places where, for example, states have said, districts, you may not force kids and staff to wear masks. We've seen that in Arizona and Iowa. And in Iowa, a federal judge recently said, nope, districts can indeed make that decision for themselves. There's also a brewing lawsuit in Arizona around this. So it's just been a very messy, chaotic, kind of difficult to follow school reopening this year where policies are really all over the map.
And speaking of all over the map, Delta is hitting different communities in different ways around the country. What have you seen in terms of schools and districts being hit hard by outbreaks and being forced to either close or change operations or quarantine lots of people or whatever the response ends up being?
Right. So we know there's about 243,000 cases of kids testing positive for COVID last week. That's about the second highest we've seen in the pandemic. It is true that very few of those kids are going to get really, really sick. But parents don't know if their kid might be that rarity, right? So latest data that we reported in USA Today has about 2,200 kids who are hospitalized around the country with COVID. And of course, it's far more likely that kids may not get really sick with COVID themselves, but they may have to go into quarantine because their school or classroom had an exposure, right? So there's a company called Burbio that a lot of us education reporters follow around the country. They were following school calendars. Now they've been tracking school closures and the type of instruction kids are getting when their schools close. So as of the most recent numbers we had on that, across the country in about 38 states, there were 1,700 schools closed. And in about half of those closures or those disruptions, about half of those kids were getting some kind of virtual instruction at home, maybe looked a little bit like last year. But in about 40% of those other cases, kids aren't getting anything at all. Schools are just closed for 8 to 10 days, maybe 7 to 10 days in some areas. And so what that really causes concern about is not so much that, you know, sort of well-off kids with lots of resources at home may not be able to do, you know, they may be able to do some educational activities and more or less keep up. But if kids don't have internet access and they don't have access to a live teacher, that's potentially 7 to 10 days that kids are just not getting any instruction, maybe even less than they got last year, you know, amid all the school closures and trying to get kids back in buildings. So it's really, you know, concerning because there's been so much conversation around, you know, disrupted learning, unfinished learning. And now in some cases, especially in places where there aren't masks, and especially in communities where there's high rates of unvaccinated people, those are where we're seeing more of the closures, right? And more kids getting Delta because they're the largest share of the unvaccinated population. So those are places where kids are just getting potentially more sick, or at least having to stay out of school more, and potentially not getting much instruction when they are out of school.
Talking to Erin Richards with USA Today. She covers education. She's based in Milwaukee. We are looking at Delta, COVID, and a new school year where masks are required, where they're not, where vaccinations are required for teachers and kids who are old enough. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think school districts should require masks for everybody in the building? Do you want to see vaccine requirements for staff and, again, students who are of the appropriate age? And if you are watching this firsthand as a student, a school worker, a teacher, a parent yourself, love to hear your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Erin, now here we've got the U.S. Department of Education looking at those states you mentioned that say schools can't require masks. They're approaching this as a civil rights issue because of the risks it could create for education for students with disabilities or compromised immune systems. Can you tell us what they're doing there?
Right. So in reality and in practice, the federal government can't force schools to do a lot in day-to-day practice, right? We've already talked about that is the purview of local school boards. They are elected by local community members. They mostly determine how your schools run, how the money gets spent. What the federal government does have control over is the enforcement of civil rights law, right? And also laws that make sure that kids with disabilities have access to a free and appropriate education, just like kids who are traditionally developing. So what the federal government is trying to do and what Biden's administration and Miguel Cardona, the education secretary, are trying to do is use every lever they have in the book to basically try to get more kids in class. And because they do have authority over civil rights enforcement and making sure kids get a free and appropriate education, they can say, look, by not mandating masks, you're putting the education of kids with disabilities at risk. Therefore, that may be a civil rights violation, and we can compel you to enact some remedy as a result of that. Now, this is going to take a bit because the wheels of bureaucracy and investigations are slow. Most likely, this wouldn't end up being a fine. In general, the federal government works out some kind of remedy or solution with the state that they're investigating or the districts that are, you know, connected to the state that they're investigating. And so that's where you're seeing the federal government kind of lean in and say, listen, the policies that you're passing are actually a violation of kids' federal right to receive an education. And that's where they're going to kind of, you know, direct their lawyers and the briefs and all of the other bureaucratic, you know, sort of leverage that they have to force districts to pass these mitigation protocols that we know, you know, from the science has shown tend to help kids stay in school. We have lots of studies last year from the CDC or that were, you know, kind of vetted by the CDC that said, look, you can keep kids in school during a pandemic, but you do have to, you know, wear your mask and wash your hands a lot. Those were pretty good even last year during the surge at keeping more kids in buildings. And so that's where they're trying to kind of use that leverage to get districts to follow those orders, even though in reality, they don't have a ton of control over local districts.
Aaron Richards is with us, K through 12 education reporter for USA Today, looking at COVID-19 and the new school year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Teachers, what's your perspective? What do you need most right now? What do you hope is different this year than last year? If you are a parent or a student in schools, what are you seeing when it comes to masks and vaccinations? What do you want to see? And whoever you are, do you think school districts should require masks for all when kids show up at school? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with USA Today education reporter Aaron Richards, looking at the start of the school year across the country as the pandemic continues and the new Delta variant. You can join in with your thoughts. Do you want to see masking in schools, for example? Call in at 800-642-1234. And if you have a firsthand account as a student, a teacher, a parent, school staffer, a community member, school board member, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess my first concern was thinking about if you went to a restaurant and you saw the people preparing your food, a guy would have a beard and real long hair, but not wear a mask on his beard or his hair. You don't want his hair in your salad, and you would want him to have to, by law, wear a mask or wear a hat to prevent that from happening. So I guess I think that they can require us to wear a mask or to get a vaccine. I just wish that we would sit there and kind of have more of a discussion rather than kind of an autocratic dictatorial downing on everybody else, telling us what we have to do without really considering the science. I think Rand Paul's statements on masks, he's a smart guy, shows that, you know, it's like stopping a mosquito with a chain link fence. The virus is just so small, it's not really affected by
Charlie,
masks.
Thanks a lot for the call. Of course, there's a lot of studies showing the effectiveness of masks. But Charlie's point, Aaron, he's the balance between top-down orders for this versus wanting to protect people's safety in a workplace, a restaurant, as he gave an analogy, or a school.
Well, what I can say is that we saw a number of large districts in the South open. They tend to open earlier than schools in the Midwest and the Northeast. And for example, in Atlanta, Fulton County Schools, that's, a large district, probably 90,000 kids. They decided not to require masks in 15 schools at the beginning of the year. That's a local decision, right? They decided not to do that. And then cases exploded. There were 1,000 positive COVID cases within the first 2 weeks of classes. And then you saw the district say, okay, well, I'm sure there's people on the school board that have the same views as your caller. But then they changed the rule and required masking after the cases rose, because the science shows that it's more effective at reducing the number of cases by reducing the spread of the virus. So I do think we have good examples of districts that have been more lax on these rules and then having to pivot, because the reality is there's more cases in school when kids and staff aren't wearing masks and community spread is really high.
Thanks for calling in, Charlie. We'll go to Jennifer now in West Bend. Jennifer, hi.
Hi. So my district is not requiring masks. And unfortunately, my son is in fifth grade, so he is too young to receive a vaccine. And we're just sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place. I can't teach him at home again this year, although I did last year. They were in schools last year with masks on, and that seemed to work fine. And now they suddenly said, nope, we're not doing masks anymore. And I feel like my needs as a parent aren't being met by the online option, and my son's needs are not being met because every time he gets a sniffle, I'm afraid that he's got COVID, and his safety is not being taken into consideration. It's just everybody else's desire not to wear masks.
Jennifer, thanks for the call. A lot of parents, I imagine, Aaron, in her position this year.
Yeah, I've certainly seen, and I'm sure everybody else has seen, quite a few responses from parents with kids too young to be vaccinated on social media. They're almost pleading now for folks to get the vaccine because their kids can't yet, right? And we know that it's safe and effective. The other thing that this caller is alluding to is, that divide between I'm sure some staff members that are vaccinated and not, or masking up or not, and as well as teachers and kids. But this is also why we've seen so many of these battles play out at school board meetings mm-hmm. across the country, where there's a very strong faction of parents that don't want their kids to wear masks, a very strong faction of parents that do want kids and staff to wear masks. And so you're seeing some of these some have not gone totally down the violent road yet, but there has been yelling, there have been people escorted out. There's just, you know, the boiling point here is this is coming down to very tense decision-making by school board members and often district administrators as well. And of course, it also may depend on, you know, who's got the majority in the community politically and sort of socially around policies they prefer in this COVID time. And so we're seeing that play out, and there's not a great resolution to it unless a certain number of parents and teachers can sort of rally a majority to sway the decision of the school board.
Thanks for the call, Jennifer, at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Linda next in Eau Claire. Linda, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think what I have to say is probably going to be a little redundant with the previous callers, but I just think that our schools should be masked. This is a dangerous time for our kids. And I think that should supersede sometimes the civil rights thing, even though I know that's extremely important. So I think a good idea is to mandate mask wearing at schools, but then offer a virtual option for those people who choose to not mask or are somehow offended by that. I'm speaking as a grandmother because, like the previous caller, my grandson is in fifth grade, so he's too young to get a vaccine. But he is spending this week at home because of an outbreak in his classroom. And, you know, unless they are required to wear masks, I don't think fifth graders are necessarily going to do that.
Linda, thanks for the call. I want to bring Aaron in on. You gave us a lot to work with there. Aaron, that the choice is, in some cases, masks or quarantining and shutting down because of outbreaks. Is that what we're seeing around the country?
It is what we're seeing. And I think what Linda was also getting to at the mm-hmm. end there is that, you know, having an option for kids to remain home mm-hmm. and do their studies from home remotely is something that parents have asked for. But we've got at least 17 states that are restricting. That's 17 states that are requiring districts to ensure students can access instruction during quarantine. At least 8 states, not Wisconsin, but 8 others, are restricting remote learning because they want kids to be in classrooms. Now, that's tricky because last year we also had a lot of teachers that were teaching to some kids in person and some kids at home. That was really onerous for a lot of folks. It's difficult. Kids on neither side feel like they're getting the full attention of their teacher. And so that's why so many districts this year have done away with that option, because it wasn't working very well for everybody. But it doesn't give parents in districts where there isn't a mask mandate a lot of options to stay home. And there's some speculation that that could drive some movement patterns to folks into private schools or, you know, online only schools that are operating independent of the district or that are, you know, part of another faction of the district. So it's really a tricky situation right now because there aren't as many options for people to just say, nope, we're going to stay home and just do online schooling from home if they don't have the option or if they don't have, you know, sort of the people power in their own household to help kids out.
Thanks for the call, Linda. We'll go to Karen next in Green Bay. Karen, hi.
Yes. I'm really disappointed because last year our school district was barraged by a huge amount of loud parents who had incorrect information, and they put out a Facebook page and you know, said all these horrible things about teachers and things like that. So I think this year now our district is not requiring masks, and I believe they folded on the issue because they don't want to deal with what they had to deal with last year. Some of these parents were almost violent, very loud, very crude, and had very incorrect information.
Karen, thanks for the call. Aaron, just in our last minute, are school boards reluctant in the face of what Karen is talking about? Aaron, are they reluctant to bring back masks?
I think some are, depending on how much pressure they're feeling from the community. We've seen instances of superintendents also resigning from their roles because they have a different view of the school board. We've also seen some school boards have elections within the last year that have brought more people onto a board that may have, much less adherence to masking than previous school board members. So you're seeing these shifts play out. And I think that, we've quoted several district superintendents and school board members who have said, this isn't what we signed up for. We're not trained for this. We're not prepared to deal with this level of sort of fury from the community, whether it's from the right or the left or to mask or not. It's really a concern. And I think we're only seeing the beginning of it at the moment. I think it's going to get more tense before it gets better.
Aaron, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Aaron Richards is a K-12 education reporter at USA Today. She talked to us about COVID and the new school year, how school districts are managing masks and mask backlashes. Still time for you to share your thoughts, maybe your experiences in your part of the state. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up, a lot of our lives are lived online these days, but how often do you think about what happens to the things we do or post online? We'll talk to two archive experts about preserving the internet. It turns out a lot of the things that end up online may not be there forever or even all that long. What's important to keep? What's important to let go? I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A lot of daily life is conducted online. School, work, communication with friends and family, keeping up with the news, listening to music. One thing you might not think about, how quickly portions of the internet that we access are constantly disappearing or changing or becoming something completely new. Our next guests are working to preserve a lot of that information. They co-wrote a piece at The Conversation about internet data, web pages, and the effort to keep them around for posterity. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a web page or social media site that you used to use that no longer exists? Do you worry about websites or apps or social media sites that you currently use that could disappear in the future? And what do you do to try to keep safe your memories, pictures, conversations that you have online? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kayla Harris is a librarian, associate professor, and archivist for the Marion Library at the University of Dayton in Ohio. Her research interests include the importance of archiving material produced online. Kayla, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And also with us, Stephanie Schreffler is a librarian, archivist, and associate professor for the U.S. Catholic Special Collection at the University of Dayton. Stephanie, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, Stephanie, I think for me and a lot of online users, this might be something we don't think of. The internet, we think, is going to be there forever. Can you talk about how much churn and loss there is online?
Yeah, so that's what you hear all the time, right? Be careful what you put on the internet because it'll be there forever. And that is not always the case. Anytime a website is updated, the page is overwritten, so previous versions of that page are lost. Or if a URL changes, that information could be lost. So there's a movement among archivists to work to help preserve that internet and make sure that it will be around for the historians of the future to research from.
And Kayla, that's where I want to pick up. Why do we worry if we're losing a lot of the stuff online? What do we lose when we lose it?
Well, the internet is a wild place. There is some content on there that maybe isn't worth saving. But as you mentioned kind of at the beginning, a lot of our daily lives now are conducted online. Things that we used to have in print, newspapers, bulletins, that sort of thing that archivists and librarians would have preserved a physical copy of, now often those things are produced only online. So unless they're archived in the same way, then we'd lose that important information.
Well, it's Stephanie, I think about if you watch a Ken Burns Civil War documentary or read history from a lot of eras, you can work with a lot of people's letters and other primary documents of the sort Kayla just mentioned. I don't know if we have as many of those letters anymore. Are we going to be dependent for this online material to understand our current era when it becomes history?
Yeah, absolutely. The letters of today are emails and blog posts and social media posts. And, you know, I bet the people in the past probably also didn't think, oh, our materials are historical. Got to make sure we save those. But they were, and now we're so thankful to have them. And it will be the same thing with the internet and other electronic materials.
And Kayla, I was trying to think of something that I've used in the past. And what came to me was, you know, 20 years ago or so, I ran a fantasy football league and I made a website for it. And I did some poking around. I don't think I'll ever find that material again. Once something is gone, if it hasn't been archived, is it likely just gone forever?
Likely, yes. The upside to that is potentially it may have been archived without you even knowing it. So the Internet Archive, there are automatic crawlers, web crawlers, or bots that crawl portions of the internet automatically. And so even if, you know, you didn't personally archive that Fantasy Football League website, it may have been crawled. However, the internet is vast. And so there's no telling if it was crawled or how frequently it was crawled. So if something, you know, was updated or it was deleted, for example, before it was crawled, then that wouldn't be captured. So yeah, it really it depends.
Well, let the record show that I was the champion 1 year. We're talking to Kayla Harris and Stephanie Schreffler from the University of Dayton in Ohio. We're talking about preserving the internet. A lot of bits and pieces of the internet or big chunks of it are lost or edited over or changed. And there's efforts ongoing to try to preserve them, maybe for future historians, maybe for journalists, maybe for our personal memories. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guests, your thoughts on this issue, and have you helped archive something yourself from the internet age? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. All right, Kayla, let's get into the how. And Stephanie just mentioned the Internet Archive. Can you talk about this big effort to keep chunks of the internet around even after they disappear from public view?
Internet Archive is really the name in web archiving. And they're celebrating their 25th anniversary this year of archiving the web, which is kind of a impressive feat to think about. And they have a tool called the Wayback Machine, which is how you can access these archived copies of websites, both that those web crawlers or bots have crawled, as well as websites that individuals have saved. So they have a tool on their website called Save Page Now. So if you are browsing a website and you see something important, you can save that individual page. Now, there's some caveats. It would say, for example, a website page as opposed to a entire website. So that would mean the difference between like saving a single news article versus archiving the entire New York Times. And there's also certain websites that for various reasons, the web designers choose not to allow their website to be crawled. But Save Page Now, there are billions of captures by individuals all over the world every day that archive web pages that way, website pages that way.
Stephanie, how important are everyday people to an effort like this? You two archive things on purpose with a goal in mind, but how much is the, I guess, citizen science of this making a difference?
Yeah, it's extremely important. Kayla and I are just two people, and of course there are many other librarians and archivists working on this, but still, it's just a small number of people compared to the entire population and compared to the size of the internet. And our knowledge base, we don't necessarily know what about all the topics that might be considered important or know about those websites. So having a broader population of people from across the country and from across the world to help save this content is really crucial, just because a few people can't do it by themselves.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Nikhil is with us in Milwaukee. Nikhil, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about?
Hey, so this is a very interesting topic. I was just thinking about that recently. Just way back when, from like college days, I had a blog that I maintained with a few kind of creative work, like prose and things like that. And I just thought about it recently, and I couldn't find that page. So what we're talking about seemed very interesting. But luckily, a few months later, I found another link for that same page, was able to locate it, and then I archived everything. But it was a big downer initially when I couldn't find that page.
Nikhil, how did your writing hold up? Was it worth going back and reading it?
I think some of them were still good. The rest of them, I was like, who is that person?
Nikhil, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Kayla, I wonder, there's probably a lot of people in Nikhil's situation where they had this thing that they did themselves or followed for a long time, can't find it anymore. Is there, I don't know, a standard operating procedure to try to track down that lost blog or whatever it might be on the internet?
Unfortunately, it's not easy. Part of the massiveness of the internet and archiving the internet is that it's not always curated or organized in an easily searchable way. So for example, the Wayback Machine, users can find a website using a URL. So you have to know a specific URL to be able to search. So for example, I ran into a similar issue where I was trying to find a live journal that I used to have during my study abroad experience. And I spent a lot of time going back on, you know, the live journal and trying to find these archived websites around the time frame, but I couldn't. I you know, knew kind of what I was looking for. So for the everyday person, it's really hard.
Thank you so much for that call, Nikhil. And I'm glad you found your lost work there. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. So, Stephanie, I know if somebody's doing a physical archive at a library or historical society, they don't just take anything. They have a curated collection where they're looking for specific kinds of stuff. And I know I think you and Kayla both do that at the University of Dayton. Can you talk about your collection and your focus when you're archiving the internet in your day job?
Yeah, so I am the archivist and librarian for the U.S. Catholic Special Collection at the University of Dayton, and that's a special collection that collects materials about the history and culture of Catholicism in the U.S. The University of Dayton is a Catholic university, so the materials I collect are focused on that topic. And for example, last spring when the pandemic started, I started a collection where I tried to archive different sites that would show the response of Catholics to the pandemic, capturing church announcements when they were closing down, diocesan announcements about the pandemic, personal reflections by Catholics about what the pandemic meant to their faith lives. So that's one example of what I have been capturing.
We're talking to Stephanie Schreffler and Kayla Harris, both librarians, associate professors, and archivists for the University of Dayton in Ohio. They're co-authors of an article for The Conversation about the Internet Archive and preserving the Internet. It turns out that things disappear or get written over or changed, and there's an effort to try to keep up and archive those things for the future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry that with us doing so much stuff online and digitally, we won't have much to look back on in the future? Is there a website or social media site that you used to use that no longer exists? Is there something you created online that you can't find anymore? Have you used the Internet Archive's app to save something online? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Stephanie Schreffler and Kayla Harris, both librarians, associate professors, and archivists for the University of Dayton in Ohio. They were co-authors of an article for The Conversation about the Internet Archive and efforts to preserve the Internet, which changes a lot over time. Things disappear, get edited, get bought out, and maybe canceled. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how we archive the internet or as much of it as we can? Do you worry about losing things? Have you lost something you either did or used to follow online that you'd love to find again? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Conrad is with us in Dubuque. Conrad, hi.
Yeah, I think it's been maybe not as common knowledge as it should be, but for a long time that the government, the NSA, I believe it is, primarily stores all electronic communications, voice communications, internet, email, everything.
Conrad, thanks for the call. My understanding was that the NSA stored metadata, who called who, not the actual recordings of the conversations. But Kayla, are you aware of any government-led effort to keep up archives? We're talking more about the websites than the emails and phone communications here.
So when governments transition, for example, that's when a lot of the websites get updated and changed. And so previously, there would kind of be these transitions that would happen and information would be taken down. But the Internet Archive and their partners with Archive It, they do archive websites of outgoing administration to make sure that that data isn't lost when we transition.
And Stephanie, you make a point in your article that the two of you co-wrote that there's another use for this. You can fact check claims about what was said on the internet if you have these archives, and you can kind of foil efforts, say a wealthy person doesn't like what's on a website, so they could buy it and get rid of all that information by archiving it. We have at least some balance to that. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, so screenshots, if you try to just take a screenshot of a web page, that's fairly easy to doctor. You can change it pretty easily and make it say something that it didn't originally change, originally say. But when you have these official captures from the Internet Archive or another web archiving tool, that is seen as a better type of evidence because it's not something that can be changed so easily. So it's these captures from the Internet Archive have actually been used sometimes in court as evidence to help prove that, you know, this web page did say this at a certain amount of time.
And Kayla, we've talked a little bit about government websites. Now I'm thinking about news outlets. So you look back at old movies and you see the reporters going through their carefully maintained physical newspaper archives. Do news sites now do a good job of archiving their material from the past?
Not necessarily. there was a kind of concerning report that we mentioned in our article that was done by the Tau Center for Journalism at Columbia. And they were looking at the digital archiving practices of news sources. And unfortunately, that's just kind of a second thought. There's not a lot of, you know, not always the resources or the idea that, you know, I backed it up somewhere, so that's the equivalent to archiving it. And while that's a good start, having, you know, kind of multiple copies of things, that's not necessarily the same thing as having an archived version of news stories online. So yeah, it's definitely something to be concerned about when we rely on news sites as kind of our evidence, our, you know, potentially, you know, unbiased or the truth of the source. And so, yeah, knowing that those are available.
We're talking to Kayla Harris and Stephanie Schreffler from the University of Dayton in Ohio, talking about efforts to archive the internet, or at least lots of it. It's subject, of course, to change. Websites go away or get replaced or edited or written over. And they are part of an effort to keep a lot of that information around for the future. Still time for your calls if you have thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Stephanie, we've got this now 25-year-old Internet Archive. We've got lots of volunteers out there helping with that effort. But are there things you'd like to see done, kind of internet hygiene from, I don't know, service providers or website creators or I don't know who, to do a better job in the first place to keep these things around?
Well, I guess awareness is the first step, really. Once you realize that, oh, these pages aren't necessarily going to be around forever, then you can start taking those steps to solve that, even if it's as simple as saving the page with the Save Page Now feature at the Internet Archive. That's a pretty simple step that a lot of people and institutions should be able to take. For anything broader based, that is a difficult question. It's such a vast place, the internet. It's hard to think about what any sort of more formal program might look like, but it would be a good idea, I'm sure.
And Kayla, one effort you mentioned in your piece was the Library of Congress. They keep a lot of important information. They had a go at, I understand, of preserving every tweet sent on Twitter. What ended up happening?
Well, they realized that the original intent of Twitter and the way it was kind of has been transformed as a tool. So, for example, they were only capturing the text of tweets. And now tweets are often used to share memes and GIFs and images. And so you're not even really getting the full context of what tweets are being shared. And they decided they changed their policy. So they kind of went back on what they said originally and said, we're not going to archive every single tweet. They're still archiving tweets that they find to be important. Former President Donald Trump's tweets, for example, were archived. There are other kind of trending topics that they archive, but not everything.
Stephanie, do you have recommendations for people with the personal stuff they have online at, say, various social media sites? Are there ways that we can curate ourselves and make sure that we have some kind of backup of the stuff we want to keep around?
Yeah, for social media, sometimes different sites offer you options to download your data to your own personal computer. So that's a way just to ensure that your profile wouldn't disappear entirely. If something happened and it was taken down, you would still have that record of your profile that you could try to recreate things. And then for things like photographs, there's a lot of backing up services out there like Google Photos or Apple iCloud or Amazon Photos. And really, if you can make multiple copies of things, that is good because maybe a service will go away at one point. So if you can have many copies of things, that'll help protect against one copy disappearing.
And we'll leave it there. Stephanie, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having us.
And Kayla, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Stephanie Schreffler, librarian, archivist, and associate professor for the U.S. Catholic Special Collection at the University of Dayton in Ohio, and Kayla Harris, librarian, associate professor, and archivist for the Marion Library, also at the University of Dayton. They're co-authors on a piece. You can read it on The Conversation, if it's still there. I think it's still there. I don't think it had to go to the archives just yet, about the need to keep online information from disappearing. And they reference the Internet Archive, where you can play along at home and curate your own archives of the internet. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7, a new lawsuit filed by a group of Wisconsin workers is challenging a rule that makes it harder for people with disabilities to collect unemployment insurance. Find out what's at stake tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a new study shows that most Americans personally know and trust their neighbors, but not all of them. We'll talk about how we can foster better relationships with those who live next to us. and why we might want to do it. Still time for you to share your thoughts, your experiences as a neighbor. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at CentralTimeWPR. Remember, you can follow these conversations all the time on the Ideas Network at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app onto your phone. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.